This gets forgotten a lot, and I think we need to remember this. We need to celebrate milestones. We need to acknowledge and celebrate your achievements, you know. And, you know, it can be challenging to deal with the VA. It can be challenging to deal with GI Bill folks. It can be challenging to do job placement, to do resume creation. It can be challenging to get rejected from job after job after job when you're more qualified than most of the people that are already there. That can be challenging. So when you are achieving these small things, don't just be like, huh, well, that's a thing. No, like, you know, take a moment to kind of recognize the effort that went into it. Celebrate the milestone, you know? That's what I would do.
Hello, and welcome to the new Mission Career Transition Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Caprellian, and I'm joined by my co-host, sister, and talent management pro, Alexandra Caprellian. We interview service members that transition to new careers, DoD representatives, and civilian HR professionals to provide you with lessons learned you won't get in a transition class and to help you transition with confidence. In previous episodes, we've talked to service members about the challenges they encounter during their transition out of the military. On this episode, we're going to dive deeper into some of those mental challenges with James Jerry, a former FMF corpsman who also is a licensed marriage and family therapist. He's going to talk about two things: how to pursue a career as a therapist, but he's also going to tell us from his experience the things that we can do to galvanize ourselves in preparation for a military transition. I certainly enjoyed this, and we think you will too, so stay tuned. James Jerry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Appreciate it.
What up, James?
Hey, Alexandra.
Hey, listen, glad to have a licensed family and marriage therapist on the net. Got a lot of questions for you. You can talk about the psychological aspect of major life changes, but also maybe some of the things that maybe challenge service members and veterans. And I'm really interested in getting your thoughts on the matter. But before we do, very briefly, what's your association with the U.S. military?
Oh man, what a loaded question that is, right? So I joined the military in 1997, I guess. Yeah, I was a Navy corpsman. I had a couple of different NECs. It was a quad zero, just like every other corpsman. I was also 8404, which is the field train cert, and I was also an 8485, which is a neuropsychiatric technician. Had some duty station time overseas, but probably the most relevant experience took place on the East Coast at an outpatient mental health clinic where I worked for about 4.5-5 years.
And what did that experience teach you about yourself and maybe the things that you wanted to do or teach you about human nature?
So I feel like I kind of got lucky. I was pretty young. I was still pretty young when I started there. The next closest person to me in age was about 7 or 8 years older than me. And so I kind of looked up to all of them. You know, there were pre-licensed psychologists. There was a psychologist that was supervising them who had, you know, done 26 years of psychological support for the prison system in an East Coast state. And there was a couple of psychiatrists that were there too, one after the other, both of which with extended experience. And then there was also a reservist psychiatrist that would come up from Florida once a month. And, you know, I got such a rich experience in managing sort of intake appointments and sort of information gathering, psychological testing, diagnosis, interpretation of said psychological testing, and managing follow-ups and presentations and statistics for the department, and It was just, you know, it was just an extremely rich experience that is, you know, I feel really kind of lucky because a lot of other neuropsychiatric technicians that worked in outpatient mental health clinics did not get the same experience. So it was pretty unique, a pretty unique time and place. I would say through all of that, I learned a few things, both, you know, specifically from that department, but also from the Navy in general, is that, you know, there's wisdom coming at you from all sides. And, you know, whether it's coming at you from somebody who's been doing something for 30 years or from somebody who, you know, who's only been there for a little while, everybody tends to have a different experience. And, you know, to limit yourself to only your own experiences, you know, kind of puts you in a bit of an echo chamber, and that can be kind of dangerous as you get older. Another thing I would say is to try new things. You know, just consistently try new things. Put yourself in situations that, you know, you wouldn't exactly do, you know, on a normal Tuesday, you know. Because I find that, first of all, you may find something you really like by accident or, you know, on purpose. But moreover, you find out how much overlap there is in life, you know, from one experience to the next. And I would say the last thing it would be that something actually that that supervising psychologist told me once, and I've never forgotten it. I think about it almost every day, and especially in my current work, is that people are more resilient than they often receive credit for. We run into people and we might see a small slice of their life, and it's so easy to make kind of a quick judgment or, you know, kind of a throwaway guess at what's going on. But, you know, for the most part, we have very little knowledge about the struggles and the successes that people face in their own lives. And, you know, even somebody that might appear to be, you know, struggling heavily, you know, it's easy to kind of dismiss the, you know, the overwhelming resilience that that person is probably utilizing to kind of get through their struggles.
Wow. It sounds like you had a really rich experience coming out of the Navy. And is it fair to say that your experience in kind of gave you the hook to pursue what it is that you're doing today?
Yeah. I had a few thoughts when I got out. You know, I've always kind of been a bit of a history buff, so I thought about maybe becoming a history teacher. But this stuff just kind of, it calls to me, and I enjoy it. You know, it feels like work. You know, I'm not going to say it doesn't feel like work, but, you know, I enjoy it. So at times it feels like work, and at times it doesn't. I would say it was reinforced. Right when I first got out, I worked a night's job for a behavioral health insurance company, and I saw the more fundamental side of civilian mental health care and how it pertains to the insurance business, and I was just really kind of turned off. I appreciate what insurance does for folks, but just sort of working within those confines just wasn't for me.
There might be others that are listening to this podcast, those that are either maybe in the Navy or in the Army and they're in healthcare, or maybe they're not, but it's definitely, you know, the thought of becoming what you do now, a licensed marriage and family therapist, is something that they want to pursue. So as somebody that understands the track, maybe you could lay out for our listeners, if I'm getting out of the military, how do I even pursue that as a career? I mean, what should be the action steps, the game plan?
Okay. Asking me the easy ones, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, if I could sort of on the fly create a how-to guide, I would say the following. I would first of all, you know, get in with the VA. Maybe we can talk about that a bit later. But, you know, figure out what benefits are coming your way and how you can utilize either your GI Bill or I think also, and they might have changed it, but it used to be called vocational rehab. But I think there's a new name for it now. But you know, getting that kind of financial support to fund your educational experience is really step one. Step two is do research on the individual program that you're looking to do, the master's program. Is where you get your undergrad, you know, doesn't really matter as much as where you're going to go and do your actual master's work. But during your undergrad, I highly recommend as you go through your psychology classes, find a lab. Find a psychology lab. Most universities, both state and private, have active laboratory settings where licensed psychologists are consistently running experiments and creating presentations, getting published. And to be a part of one of those labs is imperative because the experience that you get prepares you for the type of track if you want to follow this particular track, but it also prepares you for what's expected of you. So you're working in a lab. It equates to, I think, some kind of an independent study credit too. I think it probably take maybe 1 to 3 hours of your time a week, depending on your involvement. Sometimes a little bit more. Step two, I would say, is start rounding up a handful of your professors that can provide strong letters of recommendation. And I want to emphasize that phrase, strong letters of recommendation. You go to these professors and ask them, are you able to write a strong letter of recommendation for me? Because I want to apply to a master's clinical psychology program. And professors that are unable to write a strong letter of recommendation, you really want to go in a different direction. The next thing, you want to consider the individual program that you're going for. You want to research that program. You know, if you're looking to learn a relational style or a psychodynamic style or a cognitive behavioral style, whatever seems to kind of fit what you think your modality might be. And that can easily be sort of fleshed out in your undergrad. But whichever one that you kind of want to lean towards, I recommend that you research the program.
Can you do us a favor? Because you're using big words and I'm a Marine and I need you to help me.
Sure.
Different types of modalities. Yeah. Could you explain?
Yeah, sure. There's a strong evidence-based modality in cognitive behavioral therapy, and that's sort of, I don't want to, explain too much, it's sort of the understanding that thoughts influence emotions and feelings, and emotions and feelings influence behaviors, and, wash, rinse, repeat. And so sometimes we have things that kind of get in the way of our living the life that we want to, and a lot of times it can have to do with how we're thinking about things. And so cognitive behavioral therapy kind of works in that realm. Another one, for example, is psychodynamic theory, which is sort of a later stage, much more accessible methodology that originally started with Freud, but has sort of developed over time into something that, in my opinion only, and others may share this opinion, and I don't speak for anybody else, but what I have found is that psychodynamic approach can work for everybody, but it tends to work better for folks that have a level of insight into themselves. But ultimately, it also talks, deals with sort of unconscious desires. And oftentimes it works well with a relational style where it's the relationship between the therapist and the client that actually serves the healing. And so that's kind of a brief overview.
When you're talking about going for your bachelor's degree in psychology and finding a clinic, I mean, you're talking about getting clinic out. I mean, I'm trying to remember the time that I was going through my bachelor's degree. There were opportunities to both work for a university and get paid, not a lot, but it offered pay and it offered credits. And it was certainly time that was developing the brain cells and not necessarily drinking the brain cells away on a weekday. So I'm guessing that that's what you're talking about, right?
Well, I assume you're referring to the psychology lab part.
Yes.
So they're not so much clinics as much as meetings that are run by these clinical psychologists. They're, people have to apply to kind of get into the labs or request, and oftentimes they're interviewed. And And the labs will meet once a week, and you can sort of go over what research is currently being done, who's handling what. And then there's also like weekly learning that kind of, that's sort of one-shot learning that's happening in these meetings. And then there's sort of longer-term projects that are being done. And a lot of times the psychologists, you know, for example, one of the labs might be, for example, motivation and emotion. Another one might be industrial organizational psychology, which is a little bit more geared towards the professional sector.
Okay.
You know, so there's different types of specialties with these, with these particular labs. It's not like lab where we're in lab coats. I mean, this is, you know, it's a little bit more nuanced, and there's experiments being done and learning, and it's basically more exposure that exceeds the basic psychology educational framework.
Okay. Now that makes sense. And I know I interrupted you between that and seeking out which type of master's degree program one would want to pursue. So please continue.
Sure. So when you've sort of figured out which modality you think might work best for you, you know, find a couple of them. Don't do what I did. What I did is I put all of my eggs into one basket and applied to a program that was at the university that I was at. I was able to get in, but I suspect there was a variety of different factors. But I think the more intelligent way to do it is to have probably anywhere between 2 to 5 different schools that you're going to apply to. And what's most important, I think, as part of your application is going to be your personal statement. A lot of times they're going to ask you to kind of write a personal statement, and a lot, you know, more or less on average, it's more just kind of like, you know, why are you doing this? And it's some sort of, you know, more intelligent way of asking that question. But what's most important during that personal statement is your authentic voice. It has to come from you. And, you know, these folks that are looking at these applications, most of them are professionals that have worked in private practice or worked in group practices, or they've worked in intensive outpatient settings or inpatient. They've worked a variety of different places, and you know they're gonna be very adroit at parsing out what you're saying. So your own authentic voice is what's best, and I would recommend you have more than one person help you proofread and edit it. A lot of times, though, so now that you've submitted your application and let's say you're getting callbacks, you're getting an interview, perhaps. And a lot of times, I should say even before that part, cultural, psychological, and experiential aptitude tend to kind of be the most favored factors on average, with some exceptions here and there, depending on where you're going. But so you want to make sure that, you know, both in your personal statement and in these, some of these initial interviews, that that your aptitude in those areas is developed. And, you know, some you might get in, some you may not. You know, you accept the one program you think that best suits your needs. And the last piece of advice that I would give in this particular section is, while you're going through that program, have your own therapy on the side, because I believe that that makes all the difference.
Almost like to become a good practitioner, one must be a recipient of it.
Yeah, it helps a lot, because, you know, as you're learning to help other people, you're uncovering lots of things about yourself. Hmm. And that can provide a rich exploration that exactly like you just said, can make you a better clinician.
So let's say you've used up your post 9/11 GI Bill, or maybe not all of it, but you only have so much to be able to bridge the gap between completing your bachelor's degree and then pursuing a master's degree. With somebody that has a bachelor's degree in psychology, what forms of employment could one or should one pursue while they're working on their graduate degree?
Boy, you're not going to have a lot of time. I'll say that much. It's possible, but you're not going to have a lot of time. These degree programs tend to be intensive. So if it's possible that you can kind of do maybe work heavy before you do the program, save a little money, I would advise that. Also, grants and scholarships. Grants are especially attractive because you don't have to pay them back. And there are tons of both out there. I say again, there is a lot of money out there for students to apply for. I think a lot of folks don't, just because the system can often seem convoluted and confusing, kind of in the way that Wall Street seems really confusing to those that don't work within its confines. But I am here to tell you there's a lot of money in grants and scholarships out there. But if you're looking to work while you're in the program, sometimes a suicide hotline can be good. It's something that's sort of in the realm of the work, and it's something that you could probably do from a variety of different locations. Perhaps working on campus is a possibility. Another way might be through like community mental health centers. Sometimes there are administrative positions that, while you may not necessarily be doing treatment work, it doesn't hurt to learn how to manage a lot of the admin that kind of comes with this type of job.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I like the idea of, you know, sometimes I just forget about the opportunity for grants and other means of being able to gather money to pay for tuition and pay for cost of living fees. So let's say you're finally in a master's degree program. What does that look like, and what comes afterwards?
So it's a variety of different classes. The cohorts tend to be smaller. My cohort, for example, was 8 people. Some might be as much as 12 to 16, but they tend to be small. And this is why you want to apply to a variety of programs, because these programs are getting anywhere from, you know, 50 to 200 applications, and they're only going to select, you know, 8 to 16 maybe. You know, 16 is, and that's a high estimate. It's probably closer to like 8 to 12, and most likely closer to 8. What does it look like? It looks like an element of academia. You know, there are classes. They tend to be somewhat long in nature, about 3 hours. And on top of that, some programs will have you start to see clients right away. My program did. You know, we were seeing clients pretty quick. And actually, I felt right at home. It reminded me of a lot of the old jump in the fire training techniques that the military had to offer. It was like, get ready, here you go. And you're like, I have no experience. And they're like, we don't care, you're going to do it. And, you know, so you kind of learn by doing on top of learning academically. You're also going to have direct clinical supervision, which basically looks like an hour-long meeting with a PhD or a master's level psychotherapist. And, you know, a lot of times you'll record sessions, and of course there's, you know, people sign waivers for that, and they'll listen to your tapes and talk with you about kind of what they're hearing, what they're seeing, what are you hearing and seeing, and help you develop your clinical skills and also your insight in the sessions, and, you know, some of the basic things too, like how to manage yourself during sessions.
So after you get your master's degree, I mean, there's the whole licensing process. Could you explain that a little bit?
Sure. So, and I want to step forward and say that my experience took place in California, and my specific path was the LMFT path, but there are others too. There's a professional clinical counselors and pre-licensed clinical social workers. So there's, you know, and these tracks, they kind of overlap, but they each sort of have their own independent thing. So I can only really truly speak to the LMFT track.
Yeah, the licensed marriage and family therapist, right?
Right. So when you graduate, you become an associate marriage and family therapist, and you're an AMFT. And your new mission is to get yourself 3,000 hours of clinical experience. And then there are some requirements within that 3,000 hours that include, you know, so many hours of work with families, so many hours of work with children under the age of 18. And there's sort of a smattering of administrative and other ways to get hours. But there's lots of ways to do it. You can work at community mental health programs. There are fellowships. Several of my cohort mates got fellowships at some spots. And, you know, that, you know, they'll start you out with, you know, a full caseload rather quickly. And so you'll have 6 years from the point when you graduate to when you'll have to start making accommodations for yourself. So the general, probably I would recommend kind of grinding early. Those first couple years, you want to try to get as much of those 3,000 hours as you possibly can. And it tends to look a little different depending on the space that you're in. Some folks are working community mental health, and so there's always a draw for experience there. The folks that went to fellowships, they tend to have strong referral systems that keep people busy. I went the private practice route. I graduated right in the middle of the pandemic, so it was a little bit of a struggle to get going. But I found places I found some spots that hired me, and my first experience was at a small private practice, and I appreciated the way that the manager ran the practice. It was another one of those kind of jump in the fire situations. It was like, you know, here's how private practice looks in the 21st century, and, you know, provided a lot of information, and they were like, okay, go. And so I learned a lot of this kind of by doing it on my own and kind of checking in periodically with my supervisor. I also worked at a private group practice, which is basically a collection of professionals, you know, like behavioral technicians and other unlicensed and pre-licensed therapists and counselors, and then a couple of psychologists and a couple of psychiatrists. And the group practice was good because we were seeing a lot of students and families from some of the local school districts. And so I was able to get a lot of valuable experience there. So the referral sourcing is really important as you're trying to sort of accumulate these hours. One more thing on this, too, is you have to take a law and ethics test. And again, this is California requirements. These requirements tend to vary state by state, although I can't imagine there's too many states that aren't going to have you take a law and ethics test. So, you know, it's a professional test, so you have to go to a testing center and study for it. But, you know, you're not alone in this situation. There are lots of programs that are out there. You know, that, you know, for a price that, you know, they can help, you know, kind of teach you how to take these tests and things. And so, but also too, you know, you can look up information online and find testing books online for minimal or no price. And so, you'll have to do that. And then when you've got your 3,000 hours and you've passed your law and ethics test, you'll have to then go back and reconnect with all of your old supervisors and get signatures and go through a very convoluted administrative process run by the state. And it can be frustrating at times because when you, you can send in your application and you can see, oh, they cashed my check like a week after I sent it, but then I don't hear anything back from them for 3 months. So they excel at cashing the checks, but not always in processing the paper.
Yeah, that sounds typical. Yeah. That sounds typical. But I mean, I think one of the great things is that, just to kind of reflect back, once you've graduated with your master's degree, and even though you're an AMFT, like you're a practitioner. You know, there may be some supervision and some additional requirements along that career progression, but you're in the thick of it. You're actually helping clients. So, and I think that's pretty cool. Hey, Sis, did you have a question?
Yeah, this might be blaringly obvious, but can you just explain what the difference is of a private practice and a non-private practice? Like, what is the big difference between the two?
Sure. So a private practice can sometimes take insurance, but, you know, a lot of the time is private pay, where a client will pay the price out of pocket. And the private practice tends to kind of look like an office setting with clinical treatment rooms that are set up, you know, for therapy. And it differs from, say, community mental health, where a lot of the funding is coming from, say, the county or the state. And sort of depending on the private practice, they might have some pro bono work, but that can be kind of rare. Also, sometimes there are community centers, like community cultural centers, that offer therapeutic services that are geared towards members of a specific community. And then there are also, you know, there's other interesting ways to get hours, too. Like, for example, in substance abuse treatment, there are substance abuse treatment centers that will sort of fulfill the the role of being able to get hours and also to serve clients that's not necessarily a private practice setting, that, you know, it's kind of insurance-based. A lot of times, too, in private practices, they can range from, you know, a staff of one, you know, a person who's going to be just running their own practice, to private practice that's more of a group practice where somebody's running it and then there's a, you know, a whole staff of folks. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. No, definitely.
So after you go through all the hurdles and you pass the legal exam and you've accumulated the, at least in the state of California, the 3,000 hours necessary to be able to take the exam. I remember talking to you when you were taking the exam. It's not an easy exam.
Yeah. And this is, again, I don't speak for anybody but myself, but that exam, while it does test clinical knowledge, it is a test of stamina. That test is, it's very long. You know, it's 4 to 4.5 hours. And, you know, I think they have break opportunities halfway through. I chose to kind of just sort of power through it because I wanted to get it over with. But it's no joke. It is not to be taken lightly. You know, it's not much of this profession is to be taken lightly. But I tell you what, that test is, it's imposing. But it's not impossible. You learn how these question stems are worded. You're looking to see what of your knowledge is specialized and what of your knowledge applies across the spectrum.
Hmm. And certainly all the hours and all the interactions with those that are licensed and have PhDs. I mean, it's not like you were cramming for this thing the night prior. I mean,
correct.
This is a several years of professional development where you hit the apex. Well, I don't know if you hit an apex, but you certainly hit that milestone requiring maybe some additional study specifically for the test, but with the knowledge in the background to be able to answer the questions competently. So good on anybody that grinds that out. Now that we've covered kind of what the career path looks like or how to become an LMFT, talk a little bit more about what it is that you say you do here, Bob. Well, and I guess let me be a little bit more specific. What kind of problems as an LMFT are you typically solving?
Well, I don't solve anything for anybody, but I help others understand their situations better so that they're better able to solve their own problems. Every once in a while, there's some emergency.
You just got professor on me. You just got instructor on me. Okay. The answer to the question is yes. Okay. I get that. So what kind of problems are you helping clients solve?
Boy.
You knew I was going to give you crap too. Just a matter of time. I was looking for an opening.
It's varied. One of the things I appreciate about this job is, you know, I can be working with a successful tech entrepreneur 1 hour, and then the very next appointment is with a 16-year-old high school student who's just not impressed with my shoes. I would say that the variety of things that I face is pretty vast. Some folks are looking to better understand their life. They're looking for sort of personal development. Other folks are in crisis. And there's just about everything else in between. You know, with the veterans that I currently work with and that I have worked with in the past, the variety is just as vast. You know, some folks are dealing with some pretty significant trauma, and others are really angry. You know, it's real. It's real out here. You know, a lot of times service members get, you know, they're in the military and you know, when they transition out, you know, life's a little different and it's not as efficient and it doesn't work as well. And that's kind of the joke because it didn't work that well when we were still wearing the uniform. But now it works even less efficiently and you realize, like, actually, you know, it wasn't so bad before. Or some realize, gosh, yeah, it was terrible and this is much better. And yet also that can be just as stressful.
I just find that interesting. I mean, out of the conversations that we've had, not just on this podcast, but with others, I've heard of loneliness. I've heard of the feeling like you were separated. You had severed social bonds with others, and that certainly contributing to loneliness. But I haven't heard the angle of individuals experiencing a lot of anger. What are the reasons typically for somebody to feel angry when they get out of the military?
There is a distinct lack of brotherhood, you know, in the civilian world. In the military, you can be somewhat contained in your department. Even if you're working in international situations, there's a bit of a containment there. And so, you know, more or less, there's a bit of a social contract that in general, people are sort of working towards a common good. Some harder than others, but in general, they're working towards a common thing. Boy, out here, it can feel somewhat post-apocalyptic with people's motivations. Some folks are motivated to just not get fired, and others are motivated to fuck you over, and others are motivated to do their very best, but you know are hampered by familial constraints. And so, you know, for a service member who's sort of transitioning to civilian work, you know, the nuance is no less present, but you know, there's something different about it. You know, there's a sort of a recognition that your experience is so vastly different from other folks that are doing the same job that you can kind of feel isolated by proxy as much as you can feel isolated and, you know, right next to other people. And that can make you angry. You see how some folks might approach problem solving. And, you know, problem solving is one of the main things. Doesn't matter, you know, what you do in the military, you're doing a lot of problem solving. And some folks just aren't good at it, or they haven't had enough experience with it to develop those skills. But in the military, you know, most folks are pretty good problem solvers and can do so with a very complicated system, or can do it with extreme common sense. And once again, that can make you feel a little bit different from other folks, and you can kind of get mad, and you can start to resent folks around you a little bit. And I don't think it's that hard to do that.
I understand what you're saying now, because I would say that originally I was thinking more along the lines of frustration, but I think you're just giving the unvarnished emotion that's underlying behavior, which is anger.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a lot of times anger can manifest in other ways. I've seen anger manifest through depression. I've seen anger manifest in anxiety. I've seen it manifest in many different ways. But, you know, you dig deep enough and you can kind of start to see that, you know, frustration is just a more specific type of anger.
What should transitioning service members do that maybe may help them prepare for their transition out of the military? I mean, certainly life is chock full of transitions, whether you're graduating from high school, you're entering the military, you're leaving the military, you're starting a family, or maybe you're actually like in your golden years and you're retiring. But for specifically for those that are getting out of the military, I don't know. I mean, what are the things that service members can do to prepare for that from a psych standpoint?
I would say probably a couple things. Number one, it is normal to feel uncertain or overwhelmed. Let me say that again. It is normal to feel uncertain or overwhelmed. And it's probably normal to feel both. So, you know, you got to be kind of patient with yourself. Got to be kind of kind to yourself. You know, the world can be tough out there. There's no reason to help it out. Transitions take time, you know, so recognizing that you're adjusting to a new set of circumstances, you have to sort of think that into existence, you know, because it is normal to feel uncertain and or overwhelmed. You've got to embrace change. You know, change is a natural part of life. Evolution is a natural part of life. To resist it is to slow the process or to kind of muck it up a little bit. I would also say that, you know, it probably wouldn't hurt to maybe set some goals. They don't have to be large, overarching, life-affirming goals, but maybe, you know, maybe they could be something simple. Like, you know, I'm going to remember to, you know, to eat three times a day. I'm going to remember to brush my teeth. I'm going to remember to do this. I'm going to remember to do that. These are very basic day-to-day things, but keeping those little sort of daily rituals and activities of daily life are fundamental as you go through a life transition. You know, it's hard to maintain a positive mindset the whole way through. So I try not to, you know, I'd say try to aim for neutral. You know, a neutral mindset is one where you're anticipating but not expecting. I think we get into trouble sometimes when we have expectations and then, you know, the slightest thing doesn't go the way we expect it and it can really throw us off. And it can be a catalyst for a slippery slope event, you know. So I would say that, you know, try to anticipate and try to at least work to neutral. If you can be positive, that's great, you know, but also recognizing that it's okay if you have a negative mindset. Not everything works out smooth. Boy, be flexible, you know, semper Gumby. You know, you've got to be able to kind of roll with some of these punches because they're going to come. And they're going to come from predictable and unpredictable places. A lot of folks come home and they're sort of wary about who they want to kind of share some of their experiences with, not because they're necessarily just trying to either protect folks or feel like they're not going to be understood, but it's, you know, it can be a little bit dangerous to share those sort of aspects of yourself, which is why I recommend, if possible, I do recommend, you know, perhaps some therapeutic support while you transition out of the military. It can be very helpful to kind of check in with yourself with a licensed professional on kind of where you're at, what you're thinking, what you're seeing, and to have, you know, at the very least, a sounding board that you can kind of understand how you're seeing your situation. I would also say, you know, organization can be really helpful. Some folks getting out of the military, you know, it's like, I don't want to be any more organized ever again. I want to just throw all my socks and underwear in the drawer and it's fine. I don't want to fold my clothes.
I don't want to shave. I want the DD214 beard. Can't have it yet. Of course, wait till 5 p.m. That's 1700.
Yeah, but then your gas mask won't fit. It's you know.
Yeah, because I wear that all the time. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
The last thing I would say is, and this is, I think this gets forgotten a lot, and I think we need to remember this. We need to celebrate milestones. We need to acknowledge and celebrate your achievements, you know, and, you know, it can be challenging to deal with the VA. It can be challenging to deal with GI Bill folks. It can be challenging to do job placement, to do resume creation. It can be challenging to get rejected from job after job after job when you're more qualified than most of the people that are already there. That can be challenging. So when you are achieving these small things, don't just be like, huh, well, that's a thing. No, like, you know, take a moment to kind of recognize the effort that went into it. Celebrate the milestone, you know? That's what I would do.
Yeah, man. Those are great. Can you repeat that? I'm telling you, I gotta have to go. I love doing the post-production because I go back and I listen to this again and I take notes. I've got one other question before I turn it over to Alexandra, because I know she's got a couple of questions. So just briefly, one of the things that we as service members go through when we're getting ready to transition out of the military, we go through our, whether it's your service calls a TRS or TAP or essentially your transition program, we always talk about the VA medical claim. And I've heard opposing opinions. You know, there's some that are like, oh yeah, you got to do this. You got to document it, you know, you're seeking the maximum amount of percentage. And then there are some that walk away from the same course. And it's like, God, I feel like I'm abusing the system. And I don't know to what degree the system is abused. I'm not certain, but maybe you could shed some light on how service members should approach the VA claim process and bring into light maybe some of the medical problems they may or may not have or what they think they might have. So
I want to remind folks that a 20-mile hump with an 80-pound pack is not normal. And a lot of the exercise programs in the military tend to exceed that of civilian life. And even if it doesn't, most folks in the civilian world that are maybe working out and then are working an 8-hour day, that's not always the experience of the service member. You know, you're working, you know, 12-hour days, 16-hour days a lot of times. There's no overtime either. And you're maintaining a PT regimen. You know, all of that can really weigh on a body, and it can really stress out a body. And it, you don't always necessarily feel it in your 20s or even sometimes in your 30s, but that wear and tear, it's there. And it starts to really kind of manifest, if it hasn't already, you know, as you hit middle age. And you need to remember that this is an aspect of your service that takes place after you're out. You're free not to go for it if you don't want to, but these benefits are there. So when you're ready, go for it. I know a Vietnam veteran who actually was a POW. And, you know, he had been applying to the VA since the early 90s. And he didn't finally, you know, finish out his claim until, I want to say it was like 2006 or 2007. And so sometimes these things take time. I mean, that seems to be a pretty extreme case. But and I would say that definitely the VA process has been greatly improved during the presidencies of President Bush, President Obama, and President Trump, and even into President Biden. You know, the VA has received much more attention and significant upgrades and faster appointment times. It can feel overwhelming to navigate this system, but wherever you live, there's somewhere in your area, there's a regional person who's employed, I assume it's by the VA, I think it's by the VA, and they are representatives and they can help you apply for service-connected injury. And also keeping in mind that, you know, a lot of us served at a time when, and it might still be going on, but, you know, where people were, I mean, gosh, I knew people that were taking things out of their medical record. They were actually, like, you know, attempting to remove things from their medical record because they were afraid it was going to prevent them from getting choice duty. And, you know, so a lot of folks didn't have that. But, you know, the VA has sort of evolved to be able to kind of account for some of that. So what ends up happening is, you know, you'll apply. What the VA will do is set you up with appointments with specialists. So, for example, if you have something with your knee, or you had to have surgery on your knee or your back, they're not going to set you up with a general practitioner. They're going to set you up with, you know, with an osteospecialist. Or if it's your back, they're going to set you up with perhaps a neurologist. And they're going to be working with you and helping to examine you to assert whether or not these problems are service-connected, and if they are, what the appropriate percentage is. I think a lot of folks can become dismayed because they'll get mail back and it'll say, oh, we've determined it's service connected, but it's been, you know, it's 0% or 10%, you know, and folks are like, that's not my experience. I got tinnitus is a big one, you know, that's like military issue is tinnitus, you know, it's like, you know, I can't hear anything in the middle range, you know, but that's not necessarily a static number. Because these things deteriorate over time. Going in and getting the evaluation now and seeing that it was only rated at 0 or 10% doesn't mean that with degradation you can't go back in sometime down the road. It's like, look, I can't hear as well as I even could a couple years ago. I need this to be reevaluated. And they will reevaluate. And if there's degradation and they can see it, it's measurable, then they'll make an appropriate adjustment to the percentage. And these are, I like to think of these as benefits that are available to the service member. And these are things that service members have earned. You know, you don't just get this because you showed up. You know, these are earned benefits. And there are budgets that are set up specifically to support service members, you know, and how they can transition into civilian world. And this is just one aspect of that. So I believe that overarchingly, especially in the last 15 years, the VA has become considerably more accessible. You know, there are specialists, there are other veterans working. I think there's probably more veterans working in the VA now than there ever have been. And so there's a lot more empathy. You know, back in the 70s and the 80s, the VA was known a lot of times as a place where recently graduated doctors and psychologists could get, you know, easy training and easy experience. And, you know, while some of that is still going on, there's also a greater number of service members working. So you're finding that there's a considerable increase in empathy for people that are utilizing the services.
Hey, Sis, you had a question?
Yeah, I just had one last question, and I don't know if this can be a quick one, but if there's somebody listening to this and they're thinking, maybe they're on the cusp of thinking of this is something that they'd want to get into, maybe there's someone that needed some defining moment to give them certainty that this was a track of work that they wanted to go into. Are there any like noticeable attributes of someone that might really want to consider going into this type of work?
I would say there's one really important one, and it requires a little bit of introspection, and that's to determine, you know, are you intrinsically or extrinsically motivated? Because this type of work, I firmly believe, requires intrinsic motivation. Folks that are externally motivated don't tend to have the best experience in this work and will oftentimes self-select out. But if you are intrinsically motivated to get into this, and you feel like this is something that, you know, you can direct your motivation toward, then that's probably a good sign. Another I would say is there's an aspect of helping people here. And, you know, that's not for everybody. And that's okay. It's fine. You know, it's not everybody is internally geared to assist others. And that doesn't, it's not a problem. But in this particular profession, there's an aspect of helping people that you just can't get away from. So those are probably the top two.
James, we've covered a lot of ground here, but I'm sure there are questions that we missed. If individuals wanted to get in touch with you, how can they reach out, ask questions, maybe get a little bit of guidance, or who knows, maybe seek some therapy from you?
Sure. Well, I'm in a little bit of a life transition myself right now as I'm opening my own private practice. I think it'll be open in July.
Heck yeah, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
But after July, it will be bluejaytherapy.com. And that's spelled how it sounds, bluejaytherapy.com.
All right, great. Well, listen, we'll get that covered under the episode notes. And we'll make sure that we direct our listeners that if they want to learn more, they can reach out to you either through the website or via email. James, thanks so much, man. This is great. I didn't really know what a career path in your field looks like. And now we've got details and a blueprint. There are probably other branches that individuals can go into. So if they're not interested in going to the family and marriage therapy, there are so many other aspects of psychology where they can help organizations or help people. But it's a great blueprint. And thank you very much for your time, James.
Yeah, thank you both, Chris and Alexandra. I think that this is a wonderful thing, and I think vets will benefit from this, you know, greatly. For a very long time. So thank you very much for including me.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. We'll be in touch, James.
Sounds good.
And James Jerry, LMFT, has left the virtual studio. Sis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were, again, two top things that kind of stood out to me. And it was in the very beginning and it was at the very end. Although everything in between was great information. There was one thing he said in the beginning that was interesting. He said something along the lines of being okay in the uncomfortability, kind of stretching yourself, not staying with what you know. So when you're looking for tracks of work, really kind of extend yourself, test it out, be okay if it's not exactly what you want to do, because you might find something in those moments that might surprise you that you want to look into more. So I think we forget a lot about that because we're probably in situations all the time that are very uncomfortable and we don't want to have to face it anymore. But the truth is that you're going to keep facing it out of the military as well. So keep going with that. And then at the end, which is something that we do at my job, celebrating milestones is a big one. We always like to focus on the moments that we didn't get right. And we don't give enough appreciation to the moments that we do. And I think celebrating milestones and acknowledging them and giving yourself a pat on the back is super important, because that's what motivates you. And you, in these moments, sometimes you have to do a lot of this on your own. So you have to keep motivating yourself, right? So celebrating the milestones is a big one.
And that's just another form of positive self-talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's probably more than that too, because there's a lot of meaning behind it. And if you don't celebrate the small wins, then you're not going to have, you actually have nothing to reflect back on. I mean, you should take pride and kind of reflect on the fact that the energy that you put into something got you further along today than where you were yesterday or a week or a month before. So yeah, 100%. I mean, that was great. It was good being able to, I mean, I've known James. It was great having him on the podcast and get a real unvarnished perspective of, you know, how service members that are getting ready to transition, the things that they can do. And it's coming from somebody that was an FMF corpsman, doc, close to our hearts, just as any doc is in a Marine unit. But it was a great perspective. So another awesome episode. And if you're listening to me run my gums, motor my mouth, speak these words, thank you very much for listening. Thanks for staying on board. If you like what you heard, you can support the podcast by giving us a 5-star review. Hey, I really appreciate the fact that some people have already provided 5-star reviews. It just means that when service members are looking for information to help them with their transition, this may actually pop up in the queue a little bit sooner. The 5-star review actually helps make this information more available. You can find our new Mission Career Transition podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and other podcast apps. You can follow us on Instagram at New Mission CT. That's New Mission Charlie Tango. We would love to hear your feedback, so you can either DM us or you can send us an email at newmissionct@gmail.com, and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. If you are preparing for your own transition, know that I'm right there with you. So until next time, stay focused.